My guest today, William Hartung, is a director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. His recent pieces on the military budget that have appeared in the Huffington Post and many other online sites include Get Rid of the Pentagon Slush Fund and The House Bill is Good News for Pentagon Contractors. Welcome, Bill Hartung, to Takes on the World.
Yes, thanks for having me.
President Obama made a speech today at West Point in which he outlined his new Afghanistan policy and announced a plan to spend $5 billion on training foreign governments in counterterrorism training, particularly in Africa. How did you see his speech?
Well, there were a couple positive elements. I mean, I thought the fact that he acknowledged that not every problem has a military solution, that he pushed back against some of the hawks who wanted him to bomb Syria, have some sort of military response to what's happening in Ukraine and so forth. I felt the fact that he stood his ground on those issues, that he talked about issues like climate change, which are important to us, about building up our economy as part of our strength and part of the challenges we have to deal with. But I thought he was still a little too global in the sense of almost any problem you could think of, from typhoons to girls being kidnapped to, almost any significant problem in the world, he argued that the United States should play a role. And so I thought that was a mistake. You know, I think he wants to pursue some of these objectives through different means, not only military, but some of them will be military in the sense of arms and training, this new counterterrorism fund. And there's always a danger when you get involved on that level that it'll drag you into a conflict at a higher level. So, I would have preferred that he step back a bit from this notion that America has to have a role in every problem, has to be the indispensable nation, and talked about how sometimes countries in the region or other allies of ours have to help resolve problems without the United States playing a lead role.
We seem to be spreading our forces in all over the world, but particularly in Africa. He mentioned that Al-Qaeda has now spread itself in various places, and so we're going to be providing, or the United States is going to be providing training to counterterrorism forces in various countries. And this, of course, didn't work that well in Iraq in the long run. We don't know what it's going to look like in Afghanistan. But it also reminds me very much of what we did in Latin America in the 80s. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. The idea that you can sort of drop into a country that's got a complex conflict going on, side with the government, whether it's democratic or not, whether it's corrupt or not, training involves troops of some sort on the ground. It's not just handing over weapons. So therefore, there's always the danger of getting embroiled at a higher level. And, there was sort of a sense of, from the president, that these things are easy. And that, with the training, with the weapons being supplied, these problems would be resolved. But a lot of times, U.S. involvement actually provokes backlash or leads us down paths that we wouldn't want to follow in terms of who we ally ourselves with.
Well, leaving 10,000 troops in Afghanistan, and it wasn't mentioned, hasn't been mentioned in the media, but as I recall, the reason President Karzai would not sign the agreement with President Obama is that he rejected the notion, as did President Maliki in Iraq, that U.S. forces would be immune from prosecution by Afghans for crimes against Afghans. And the new presidential candidates say they will sign that. But that whole arena, which included the killing by drone strikes, is one of the things that really forced Karzai, who had been very close to America before the war, to become more of a nationalist. And if that continues to exist within Afghanistan, with 10,000 troops there, the likelihood of American troops killing Afghan civilians will still exist, and the war, in fact, will not be over. Do you see it that way?
As long as there are troops on the ground and as long as the conflict is as it is, where the Taliban has quite a bit of strength around the country, and government perhaps controls Kabul and a few other key areas. I think there's a danger of U.S. troops, generating swing casualties. I think depending what they do about the drone strikes, they're not as accurate as advertised. So I think there could still be a possibility of generating antagonism among significant portions of the Afghan public, much as has happened in Pakistan. So I think a cleaner break would have been better. I think, postponing things, this war under Mr. Obama's timeline would end up going at least 15 years before the withdrawal of U.S. troops, and that would be the longest war in our history. And it's not clear what we've accomplished in terms of actually changing people's lives in Afghanistan.
Now, I noticed that some former neocons, or not former neocons, people like Robert Kagan, Paul Dobrzynski, they've been writing recently that the U.S., Obama's position has been weak, and the U.S. can't afford to be tired. Americans have a role to play in the world, and that includes building up our military and being the dominant player. And how does the military budget reflect that agenda?
Well, it's been an interesting set of contradictions on the Republican side. You still have that neocon tendency, which seems to argue that more use of force, more spending on the Pentagon, more the notion of the U.S. as a go-it-alone dominant power is somehow going to secure peace in the world. And I think we saw, certainly in Iraq, that kind of approach does not provide those results and actually causes more problems than it solves. But there is a kind of libertarian sort of Tea Party strain in the Republican Party that, because they're so desperate to shrink government, are willing to see cuts at the Pentagon. And so as a result, although it's not nearly enough, the Pentagon budget has come down about 10% in the last few years, and I think there will be battles to push it down further. And the rhetorical fight will be about things like Ukraine, where the United States really has no military role. But neocons and others will argue, well, if we were spending more, Russia would respect us and they wouldn't have moved into the Ukraine. Or we have to be able to position troops in the region more quickly and so forth. I think none of those would be productive actions. So in terms of a sane foreign policy with realistic goals, I think the current Pentagon budget is far in excess of what would be needed for the basic defense of the country and support of allies, not doing it for the allies, but providing a supporting role in a crisis, not just any problem that comes down the road.
You write about how much bigger the U.S. military budget is than all the countries of the world combined, and particularly of our likely, quote-unquote, opponents, China and Russia.
Yes, and I think, the arguments of the hawks are that we have to be able to fight anywhere, at any time, anywhere on the globe, and have superior forces. But that's not a realistic goal. If there's a conflict on the border of Russia, the United States is not going to move 500,000 or a million troops there to create a comparable force. The Chinese fight over the South China Sea with U.S. allies in the region, the best hope of realizing a resolution of that is going to be diplomacy. And the United States is handicapped in that regard because our Senate has not ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty. So we can be pointed to by the Chinese as being hypocritical in the sense that here we're talking about diplomacy, and yet we don't seem to back that up in terms of the positions that our own government takes, the official positions. So certainly in terms of defending ourselves, having that level of margin of excess spending compared to other key countries demonstrates that we have more than enough. The only time that you get into an argument is if you're arguing that we need to be able to project force right up against the borders of a potential adversary, which often is provocative and actually prompts a response and an arms race more than it creates security.
One of the things that has depressed me as well as intrigued me is the battle over recent years to fund a fighter, a stealth fighter called the F-35, the most expensive military vehicle ever created, with expenses be at least in the area of $100 million a pop. And the fact that the United States has brought in a number of countries, Turkey, Norway, Australia, Italy, Israel. Israel's going to get theirs for nothing. But a number of countries to fund this fighter, which is not even available yet, and which seems like these countries are preparing for a war that will involve children that aren't even born yet.
Well, it's an amazing testament to the power of the arms lobby, I think, because in addition to the cost problems, the fact that it has a whole series of performance issues, they've had cracked wings, they've got a communication system, a special helmet for the pilot that's supposed to give them situational awareness, that's not working, the basic software is not, you know, ready for prime time, and the cost continue to grow, and there's not a clear sense of the mission. The conflicts that the United States has fought in the last few decades have involved countries that barely have air forces and certainly don't have sophisticated anti-aircraft equipment. And current U.S. fighters are already the most capable in the world. And it's not clear that the F-35 will be more capable, given all the problems that have arisen so far. So this has a lot to do with Lockheed Martin, playing the jobs card. They've made exaggerated claims about how many jobs there are in various states and congressional districts. And we did an analysis of that and found they were probably doubling the real number in their effort to do PR on behalf of the plane. Also, they neglected to say that it appears that there may be more contractors overseas working on the plane than there are in the United States. So a lot of those jobs are not based in the United States, but they're still trying to count them in their efforts to get Congress to spend money on the plane. So I have hopes that that project will be scaled back. There's a group of organizations working towards that end. They've done a good video on the F-35 called The Jet That Ate the Pentagon as an educational tool. But it's a tough fight because the Air Force wants it and Lockheed Martin wants it. The Navy is less interested. That they'd be perfectly happy if they hadn't been roped into the program. The Marine version has so many performance problems that it may or may not survive. But no matter how we slice it, we're likely to spend much more on this plane than advertised and for a purpose that's unclear. $1.4 trillion over the life of the plane, buying it and maintaining it, sustaining it, is the current price tag. That could come down a bit, hopefully, if they buy fewer planes. But given the record of cost overruns at the Pentagon, we can't count on that. So I think anything that could be done to expose the problems of that program, try to rein it in, would be time well spent.
What is in it for these other countries? I mean, Australia's bought 78, Norway, Italy. Is it a matter of jobs? Are people being paid off? I mean, do the voters, the people of these countries believe that they should be investing at a time where the world's generally is in economic doldrums, that they should be spending money on a fighter plane for a war that might never take place? It's kind of what's in it for these countries that they get involved in this to such a degree?
Well, they have. Lockheed Martin and others have played the jobs card all over the world, and they're basically promising the same jobs over and over. You know, they're saying the program creates 125,000 jobs, and your country will get X number, your country will get X number. And by the time you add up all the promises, there's far more jobs being promised than could possibly ever be delivered. I think also countries are under the impression that this is a way to keep a hand in sort of the high end of military technology, which I think may or may not occur. Lockheed Martin will have a lot of control over who gets what levels of technology, you know, beyond even the U.S. government. And I think there's a notion of, you know, maintaining a good relationship with the United States. And I think, I'm sure there was a lot of arm twisting of allies to buy into this program. So yeah, I think it's part kind of economics and greed, and it's part geopolitics in kind of the counterproductive sense of the term.
The jobs seems to be the big selling point here, and the military-industrial complex has managed to create factories in a number of congressional districts where, by coincidence, the members of those districts sit on the House Armed Services Committee. How did this all come about?
Well, it's a common strategy that's been used certainly as long as I've been involved in this issue, going back to the late 70s when the Carter administration terminated the B-1 bomber program and the Reagan administration brought it back. Rockwell International, the contractor on the plane, the prime contractor, used exactly the same kinds of arguments that Lockheed Martin's using today to try to sustain the F-35. And so part of that is not just making claims about jobs, but it's the strategic location of the prime and subcontractors. So, for example, Buck McKeon, the current head of the Armed Services Committee, has F-35 work happening in his district, also has his main political campaign contributions coming from companies like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman that are involved in the F-35. And it cuts both ways. Sometimes members from areas that have significant military contracting activity seek out Armed Service Committee seats so they can service those companies in their district. But sometimes the company actually looks at a member who might be helpful and says, well, let's move a factory there, or let's get a subcontractor there, and we can kind of rope this member in based on economic factors, perhaps to support a project that they otherwise would not support.
Now, you write about there's the big fight of maintaining in district, but by Congress as opposed to the Pentagon, the 810 Warthog support fighter, which was very active in Iraq, not so much in Afghanistan, but certainly in Iraq, and Congress is determined to keep this A-10 in action and manufactured, whereas the Pentagon appears to maintain that it would be replaced if and when it comes into service by the F-35. You write that actually the Warthog has a better case than the F-35.
Well, in the unfortunate case of having a war where you need air support for the troops, the A-10 has worked quite well, and it actually has had more success because it can go lower than some of the fighter planes and so forth. But, of course, they're already built, and so there's not going to be a lot of, there's not going to be tens of billions of dollars of work involved in sustaining those already existing aircraft. Whereas the F-35 is a plane in search of a rationale, and so if they can argue that it can take over that mission, among others, then that's another feather in the cap of the F-35 program. But what experts like Pierre Spray, who was a fighter plane designer who worked in the Pentagon, Winslow Wheeler, who filed these issues on the Hill for decades, they pointed out that because the F-35 tries to do everything, it doesn't do any of those things well. It's not that efficient at bombing because it has relatively small capacity, so it can be stealthy. Travels too fast in some cases to travel low and actually be of help to the troops. There's different requirements to land on an aircraft carrier than to do an airstrip on land. So they've kind of created this Frankenstein monster of a program that's good at soaking up Pentagon funds but isn't particularly good at doing any of the missions that they're saying it will be used for.
You write about another plane, the Boeing EA-18G Growler electronic warfare plane. You write it's a transparent effort to keep Boeing's St. Louis area production line open, despite the fact the Pentagon sees no need for the plane. That reminded me after the first Gulf War, the Saudis, who had funded most of that war, told President Bush that they couldn't pay for a order of jet fighters in the McDonnell Douglas plant in St. Louis. And if that deal collapse, the plant was going to close, and President Bush at the time said, "You have to buy these planes. We'll figure a payment deal out." And they figured out a payment deal so the Saudis could still buy those planes. And the night it was announced that the deal had been signed, they partied all night in St. Louis. It just sounds like this military weapons programs are simply jobs programs. And other than if you're a soldier or a family of a soldier, what happens with these weapons doesn't have any effect on American lives.
I think that's right. In fact, in some cases, they make the war more dangerous. The Saudis, a couple of years ago, concluded a series of packages of arms deals with the United States worth $60 billion, which was the biggest arms package in the history of U.S. arms exports. And that included six dozen or so Boeing planes, many of which would be built in St. Louis. But even with that order, the plant in the St. Louis area could close down as early as 2016, which is why they're trying to add this Growler aircraft to the budget. It's going to be a very difficult fight because, at least for this year, the budget is capped. And so they're going to have to take on Lockheed Martin and get rid of some F-35s, most likely, in order to make room for the Growler. So you're going to have the two of the titans of the military-industrial complex fighting each other in this case, which, the only sort of, I guess, positive side is they have less time and effort to try to pump up the Pentagon budget overall because they're busy fighting over the existing pie. But it's, it'll sort of put their other lobbying techniques on display, because Boeing is feeling desperate about keeping this particular factory open.
My guest is William Hartung, and we're talking about the U.S. military budget. Where in the military budget are the costs for overseas bases? We've read that despite the fact the United States left Subic Bay a colossal ecological disaster, that the United States is going to have new bases, and Clark Air Force Base as well, new bases in the Philippines, and there are protests in Okinawa about expansion of the U.S. base in Okinawa, which I haven't read anywhere. Where in the budget are these payment for the expansion of these bases included, or is it in another budget?
Well, sometimes they actually are somewhat transparent about it, and they put it in the military construction budget. But often it's buried in a huge category called operations and maintenance. And that includes spare parts. It includes spending money on private contractors. It includes a huge array of things. And it's not very well described in the budgetary document. So even a member of Congress who would care to know such a thing would have to push the Pentagon fairly hard to find out. It's not sort of just out there in the regular budget documents for all to see. So it's a little bit of a hidden cost in that sense.
Do these costs for base building ever get published, or do you have to do a Freedom of Information Act on it?
Well, some kind of skilled budget analysts have sort of taken a dive into the budget and done estimates. But probably you would need a Freedom of Information Act request to get a kind of more precise number or set of numbers. However, they're often cagey about responding to those things. They'll sort of say, well, unless there's an existing document that you're looking for that has this information that you can identify, we don't have to respond to your request. So it's kind of a catch-22, because if you don't know what the document is, it's hard to ask for it in a specific way. So I think they've done a pretty good job of burying those numbers. I mean, the biggest cost is keeping the troops overseas and keeping the equipment overseas and keeping the equipment up and running. But they also make arrangements with local, with the host country, certain payments to kind of offset the cost of the base. But often that doesn't address things that you've discussed, like the environmental consequences. So it's kind of a very kind of short-term vision that countries take sometimes when they decide to host these U.S. facilities.
There used to be a caucus in the Democratic Party that would come up with a opposite budget, a substitute budget. Is there such a thing in the Democratic Party in Washington these days?
Yes. The Progressive Caucus does an alternative budget every year, and some of the leading figures are people like Keith Ellison, a representative from Minnesota. And their budget that they proposed for 2015 would have spent considerably less than what the Obama administration put forward and would raise more revenues, and put more money into infrastructure and domestic investments. It's been hard to get that to be seriously considered. You know, I don't know that their budget as a whole has been brought to a vote anytime that I'm aware of, but it is a kind of an educational document, and they try to pursue elements of it in the legislative process, which can be a very difficult slog, but, you know, going up against particular systems like the F-35 or pushing votes about how soon to get out of Afghanistan. So the Progressive Caucus, which last time I looked was maybe about 80 members, I may have said that, I think could be a stronger force if they worked in concert. They made more noise. They voted in concert on some of these issues. They deployed themselves in strategic committees and so forth. But I think they play an important role, at least as a voice there in Congress, for a more rational Pentagon budget.
Well, we do have a call, so let's go on the line. Hello, you're on Takes on the World.
Good morning. This is Jim Houle. Your guest mentioned War Machine in Search of a Rationale, which I thought was a wonderful phrase. With regard to that, I wanted to ask him a question. The 9/11 was a wonderful rationale for the war against terror, and I'm wondering whether he would think that the evidence that Greenwald and Snowden have will ever be exposed to show how the demolition of the World Trade Center with nanothermite could be exposed and show how that was a false flag for all of the war on terror. I know that's a mouthful. Thank you.
Well, I don't know whether the Snowden-Greenwald documents are going to shed any more light on the September 11th attacks. You know, my main concern about it is that they were used, in fact, the United States was attacked, was used as a rationale to put forward this kind of global strategy, a lot of which had to do with things that were completely unrelated to September 11th, most notably the war in Iraq, where people like Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and others who had been members of a group called the Project for the New American Century, who had been calling from the late 90s on to overthrow Saddam Hussein. They even had it in one of their documents, sort of a phrase that said, well, you know, it's going to be hard to rouse people to this cause unless there's some kind of devastating event like a new Pearl Harbor. So when September 11th happened, they seized upon the public mood of insecurity caused by that attack to push for the Iraq War and even tried to make arguments about ties between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, which their evidence, of course, fell apart. So my concern about, you know, how 9/11 has shaped our foreign policy really has to do with kind of the overstatement or the mischaracterization of the threat that we face and the use of it to launch this kind of global initiative. I think, you know, President Obama has talked about getting the United States off of a war footing. He said, you know, stop using the term global war on terror. I would like to encourage that direction. You know, I think the problem is so far it's been more of a change of tactics. Fewer boots on the ground, more drone strikes, use of special forces. So the Obama administration is still has a fairly interventionary foreign policy, but thankfully it doesn't include things like trying to fight new Iraq or Afghan scale conflicts.
Actually, one might make the argument that going back to 1979, the decision by the United States with the Saudi funding to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan set the table for what's happened since. It destabilized not only Pakistan to this day, and it's interesting, before 9/11, Colin Powell had negotiated with the Taliban and paid them the ridiculous low sum by today's standards of $40 million to curtail the heroin trade. And the Taliban did that. And today, the heroin trade out of Afghanistan, which the Taliban participates in, is supposedly the largest amount of heroin coming out of Afghanistan in history. It's an ironic response a questionable response by the United States to 9/11. Maybe your comments on that.
Well, the problem with many problems, but the problem with the effort to supply the Mujahideen to fight the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, one key problem was that there was no control over where their weapons were going. So the Pakistan intelligence services kept hold of some of those weapons, distributed them to fundamentalist groups that they shared interests with. Some of them leaked out to other fundamentalist groups around the world. Osama bin Laden was involved in supplying the Mujahideen, so at a minimum he rubbed elbows with and probably trained alongside CIA assets at the time that Al-Qaeda was kind of in formation. So it was a huge boomerang effect, or some people call it blowback, where the effort to fund and support those groups ended up creating the seeds of a new generation of enemies. And it shouldn't have been a surprise. I mean, some of the Mujahideen groups, said, back around that time, once we get done with the Soviets, then we will take on the United States. So I think that was a huge strategic blunder that we're still paying a price for now.
Is there, getting back to the domestic agenda, is there any prospect for taking on the military-industrial complex? Many times people have repeated the warning that President Eisenhower made when he left office. And you wrote a book about, you call it The Prophets of War. You spelled it in the Old Testament way, Old Testament prophets, but it works both ways. That they seem to be dictating a certain drive in foreign policy that demands that the United States be dominant, in a sense, following the PNAC agenda of having the U.S. exert total dominance over any country or combination of countries that might think of competing with it. So in a sense, the neocons are working hand in glove with the military-industrial contractors. Is that what you say?
Well, I think they're not always shoulder to shoulder, in the sense that the military contractors want money. And if they could keep us on a permanent war footing, even without going into conflict, I think they would be fine with that. But there were links back at the time of the intervention in Iraq. There was a guy named Bruce Jackson, who was a VP at Lockheed Martin, who was the executive director of the Project for the New American Century. Some of the think tanks that were most vocal on behalf of going to war in Iraq received funding from Pentagon contractors. So there certainly are links. I think sometimes their interests, I would say, if anything, the neocons and their ideology are probably more aggressive even than the some of the companies in the arms lobby. But certainly there's an overlap there.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour. William Hartung, I want to thank you. People want to read your articles. They go to where?
Well, probably the best place is my spot on the Center for International Policy website. It's ciponline.org. And they can either search me or go to my project, the Arms and Security Project. And pretty much all my recent materials will be there.
Well, thank you so much again for being our guest today and shedding some light on this important subject.
Yes, thanks for having me.